Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Jewish Federation of Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Joseph Telushkin, rabbi at the Synagogue for the Performing Arts in Los Angeles, and author of several books, including Jewish Literacy, The Most Important Things to Know About the Jewish Religion, Its People, and Its History, and, with Dennis Prager, The Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism, and Why the Jews, the Reason for Antisemitism. He'll speak on the topic, The Sky is Not Falling, God, Love, and Money in Times of Crisis. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 20th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Stephen Abraham, rabbi at Bethel Synagogue in Omaha, Nebraska.
When I was a freshman at Indiana University, I have to admit that I got through my Jewish history class and I got to a night and a half before the final exam, and I hadn't exactly studied as hard as I probably should have for that biblical history exam. The teacher was not as engaging as I could have hoped. And I looked on my shelf and I found a book called Jewish Literacy. And it was given to me when I graduated high school from Or Kodesh Congregation in Bethesda, Maryland. And I took this book down and said, "Oy, I hope to God some of the answers maybe are in this book." And what I want to thank Rabbi Telushkin for is, had my professor been as engaging as Rabbi Telushkin was in his own words about Jewish history and Jewish knowledge and Jewish thought, I probably would have paid a lot more attention to the professor and wouldn't have had to study as hard that night. But you got me an A. So, and you put me in rabbinical school, which is either a blessing or a curse. I want to read a very short introduction of Rabbi Telushkin, but it is due to him and Kavod Harav that we read this. So Rabbi Telushkin was named by Talk Magazine as one of the 50 best speakers in the United States and is the author of Jewish Literacy, The Most Important Things to Know About the Jewish Religion, Its People, and Its History, the most widely selling book on Judaism of the past two decades. Jewish Literacy has been hailed by leading figures in all the major movements of Judaism and has been published in a third edition in 2014. He published The Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the most influential rabbi in modern history, a New York Times bestseller, hailed by Ruth Messenger as an outstanding personal biography. While there is much more to say, I add with Rabbi Telushkin was ordained at Yeshiva University in New York and pursued graduate studies in Jewish history at Columbia University. He resides in New York City with his wife, Devorah, and they have four children. He lectures throughout the United States, serves as senior associate of Klal, and on the board of directors of the Jewish Book Council, and we are thrilled to welcome you to Omaha, Nebraska.
I'm asking him for a watch because I use my cell phone. I use my cell phone as my watch. I don't want to have my cell phone on in front of me, but he has to
just touch it.
Okay.
Somebody remember he's got my watch.
Actually, I like this watch. I think this watch is worth an A. What I'm speaking on tonight, as you heard, was written up, The Sky is Not Falling, God, Love, and Money in Times of Crisis. I had really started speaking about this theme and thinking about this theme some years ago during the financial crisis that started in 2008-2009, and I was noticing how much the financial crisis was actually affecting people's own feelings of self-worth. And it reminded me of an incident my father had told me about. My father, Shlomo Telushkin, Alav Shalom, was an accountant, and he had started working as an accountant in the 1930s. And I later had occasion to write about my father's accounting because he became the accountant for the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I write about that, of course, in the book I wrote about the Rebbe. But my father never had the world's most lucrative practice, but he loved his work because he was working, as in the case of Chabad, for organizations he felt very close to. One of them was Mizrahi, which was the organization of religious Zionists. And he was working there when the president of the organization was Mayor Berlin. Rabbi Berlin, later, his Hebraized name was Bar Ilan, and the university was named for him. Berlin came to the United States for a number of years as an adult. And one of the things that happens when you learn English as a foreign language, your most problematic issue, of course, are idioms. It's like I remember somebody once said to me, I'm giving up. I'm never going to learn English. I said, what's the problem? He said, ever since I found out that slim chance means the same thing as fat chance, I've decided I can never learn this language. So Berlin was very cognizant of idioms, but there was one American idiom that my father said really irritated him, got him very angry. And it's the use of the word worth, as in so-and-so is worth, followed by a certain sum of money. He said, who ever heard of defining the worth of a human being by a sum of money? And in fact, when somebody mentioned a certain man who, during the Depression, was worth $200,000, which at that time was an enormous sum, but Berlin did not have such a high regard for that man, he said, yes, that's what he's worth, not one penny more. So how does one counter the trend in a sense? You know, it always bothered me. I was very active in the Soviet Jewry movement to get Jews out of Russia. I always had very strong anti-communist feelings. And I always felt when we were growing up, what was the antonym of communism? Capitalism. I always thought that was bad. The antonym of communism was democracy. The antonym of fascism is democracy. And to define it just as capitalism is probably not a good idea, because if you live in a capitalist society, it's hard not to define yourself by your financial worth. You know, it's built into the very word. And one of the things that struck me, so what are some of the antidotes to having that feeling of a decline in a sense of self-worth? One is rooted in the most famous verse in the Torah, which is, "Ahavta le'recha kamocha," you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So the explicit command is obvious, love your neighbor. What's the implicit command? To love yourself. And think about it. When are you apt to be nicer to other people? When you're feeling good about yourself, or when you're feeling bad about yourself? When you're feeling a lot of self-doubts and other things, you tend to be more critical. When you were a kid and you got in trouble in school and you had to tell your parents, did you really want to come home and find that your parents were in a somewhat self-loathing mood? You knew that they would be nicer when they were feeling good about themselves. And it reminded me, of course, of a story I had heard about the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was a very famous Eastern European rabbi from White Russia, Belarus. He lived a very long life. He lived from 1838 to 1933. He lived during the last period in history when it was possible to be famous without being widely recognized. Because photography was only starting to come into its own in the mid-1800s. We know, you know, we've all seen photographs of Abraham Lincoln. But it was, first of all, less widely used in Europe, certainly in Eastern Europe. And many observant Jews didn't want photographs taken of themselves at all. So here you had the Chafetz Chaim, who's growing up in the 1860s, 1870s, already widely known, but not widely recognized. He was widely known because as a young man, he wrote a book called Chafetz Chaim, Lover of Life, and he became known by that book. And it was a book about fair speech, not to speak Lashon Hara, not to speak unfairly of others, and he would go around lecturing on it. So he was once on a train going to a community to give a lecture, and a man is sitting opposite him, who clearly is also like he, an observant Jew, and he starts talking to the man, and he asks the man, where are you going? And the man says, I'm going into town to hear the Chafetz Chaim speak. He's the greatest tzaddik, the greatest saint, and the greatest Talmid Chacham, and the greatest scholar in the Jewish world today. The Chafetz Chaim was a little embarrassed at hearing himself described in such grandiose terms. So he said to the man, I happen to know the Chafetz Chaim. He said, he's not such a great person. And he's certainly not such a big scholar. The other man gets so angry at hearing him speaking so disrespectfully, he slaps him. Okay. The train arrives in the town. That night, the man goes to the speech, where to his utter mortification, he sees that the man he slapped was the Chafetz Chaim. So after the speech, he goes over and he says, Rabbi, I had no idea it was you. Please forgive me. The Chafetz Chaim said, there's no reason for me to forgive you. It was my honor you were defending. He says, on the contrary, I learned an important lesson from you. I've been going around telling people for years not to speak Lashon Hara, not to speak unfairly of others. You've taught me don't speak badly about yourself either. So one of the things that we have to cultivate during times of crisis, and what initially got me into thinking of all about this was the financial crisis. But all of us have one form or another of different crises that occur in our lives, and that can affect our, you know, our own sense of self-perception. So we have to be conscious of how we speak to ourselves about, and about ourselves. One of the things I wasn't expecting when I started working on the book on the Rebbe was the extent to which the Rebbe was very much taken up with the importance of the issue of positive language. And I learned about it early in the book when I found out, well, I'll get a sense here of how many of you know Hebrew. Who knows? If you know the word, say it in Hebrew. How do you say hospital in Hebrew? Beit Cholim. Beit Cholim is the Hebrew word for hospital, but it really literally means the house of the sick. The Rebbe had a campaign to try and get Israeli hospitals to change their names from Beit Cholim to Beit Refuah, a house of healing. And the Rebbe argued that that is not only more encouraging to people than going to the house of the sick, but actually is more accurate because a hospital's goal is to heal people. When I learned this, I remember it reminded me of something that I had heard 50 years ago when I was a teenager. My mom, who grew up in New York City, told me that when she was growing up, there were hospitals in New York called the Home for the Incurables. You know, I'm not a big fan of political correctness, but in this case, I'm pretty happy they no longer use terms like Home for the Incurable. You imagine saying to somebody, oh, by the way, we're transferring you tomorrow. There was a very famous chazan in the first half of the century named Yossele Rosenblatt. And Yossele Rosenblatt, I was reading a biography of him, had performed at the Montefiore Home for the Incurables. And I saw in the biography a thank you letter he got from Jacob Schiff. Jacob Schiff was the biggest American Jewish philanthropist in the first part of the century, thanking Rosenblatt for having appeared there and saying, you brought such cheer to the inmates. I thought, genug, it's enough. It's not enough that it's called Home for the Incurable. The people there have to be called inmates. So the desire to speak a more positive language, I'll give you another example of it. In Israel, there are a category of people who've been badly hurt in Israeli wars, and they're called Nechei Tzahal, the handicapped of Tzahal. And these are people who've obviously suffered terrible injuries. In 1976, only 3 years after the Yom Kippur War, a group of Nechei Tzahal were brought to the United States, both for some medical consultations and also to give people a bit of an excitement. And one of the places they visited was Chabad, 770, and they met with the Rebbe. And the Rebbe was known that his public speeches, by and large, were almost only in Yiddish, but he spoke that day to them in Hebrew. And one of the things he said to them, he says, you know, when people have a handicap, they usually compensate in some other area. Like we know, people who are blind often develop a more acute sense of hearing. They are cognizant of things we wouldn't notice. So he says almost all people who have a handicap develop some exceptional ability. Why define you then only by your handicap? Why call you Nechei Tzahal? You all have some compensatory, extraordinary abilities. Why don't we call you Mitsuyanei Tzahal, the exceptional ones of Tzahal? By the way, if we start looking at other people with these sorts of terms, we also can start looking at ourselves more sympathetically. That's what I meant when I said love your neighbor as yourself implies also the love of yourself. Another one of the things that the Rebbe taught was he never liked people to use the word deadline. So while working on the book, I thought, what's a good alternative to deadline? And I came up with due date. And think about the difference. Deadline is about death, and due date is about life. And so I became very happy. I spoke in El Paso, Texas, And a few days later, the Federation there sent out a notice, from now on, we will no longer use the word deadline in any Federation notices. And I'll tell you just one last thing. When I was writing the book, I tried not to use any anonymous material, because you never know if it's accurate. But there was one story I couldn't track down, but it was such a good story, I included it. A man came to the Rebbe, and he was very unhappy. He had led a very traditional life. Now his son seemed to be throwing off his Judaism, wasn't interested, and he was going on in a sad way. And finally, he sort of said, you know what they say, es ist schwer zu sein ein Jid. It's hard to be a Jew. How many of you are familiar with that expression? Okay, a lot of people know it. People know it in Yiddish. It's one of those Yiddish expressions that became known in English. The Rebbe said, I'm just curious, do you often use that expression? So the man said, well, yes, it is. Church is on a Yid. It is hard to be a Jew. So the Rebbe says, so then why are you surprised that your son doesn't want to be Jewish? Why don't you say, es ist gut zu sein ein Yid. It's good to be a Jew. Maybe you'll start influencing him in a different way. So one of the things we start to realize is we have to start looking at ourselves, even during times of crisis, with the loving eyes. We have to have the compassion for ourselves that we want others also to have for us. Doesn't mean we have to become egomaniacal, but it means we have to be fair in judging ourselves as well. I remember a story I came across about Stephen S. Wise. Stephen S. Wise was probably the leading figure in the American rabbinate, also in the first half of the last century. And in the aftermath of the 1929 stock market collapse, a man came to see Wise. He had lost everything. He had obviously been heavily margined in the market. So, you know, even a stock doesn't have to go to zero in such a case if you're margined, if you have debts, for you to lose all your money. He only had one asset left, his life insurance policy. And he had nothing else for his family. So he decided he was going to commit suicide. You know, if you commit suicide, they don't pay your life insurance, but only if it's shortly after you bought the policy. If you've owned it already, I'm not saying all this to give anybody any ideas. You know, okay. So he came to consult with Wise because he wanted to do it for his family. Now, I have a sneaking suspicion the man wanted to be talked out of it, because if you do want to commit suicide, you don't generally go and ask a rabbi whether or not you should do it. But anyway, Wise said, let me understand something. You want to commit suicide because you feel your family will need the money. So the man said, yes. So he says, so consult with your family. Ask them what they think you should do. If they tell you no, that they'd rather be poor and have you alive, you have your answer. And if they answer yes, are you going to commit suicide for the sake of a bunch of ingrates like that? So one of the first things I say is a cultivation of an appreciation of self, which can be endangered when we live in a society where worth is equated with a sum of money. And believe me, many, many of us have to struggle with that issue. People who are rich, often, they have it because they feel maybe they're appreciated because of it. They could become very nervous. I had occasion to work with a man who was a billionaire, but he grew up quite poor. He grew up during the Depression, and I saw that he could be any endangerment of his wealth could be very nerve-wracking to him. And certainly people who have less money, it's very, very troublesome to them. The whole idea of human worth ties in with another related teaching in the Talmud. I would say if I have a favorite Mishnah in the Talmud, the first strata of literature in the Talmud is called the Mishnah. It's the first attempt really that was made to systematically present Jewish law. It's in 63 short books. 62 of them are law books, like the laws of Shabbat, the laws of Brachot, the laws of making blessings, civil laws, Baba Metzia. And there's one book of aphorisms. It's called Pirkei Avot. It's generally translated as the Ethics of the Fathers. The fourth chapter, the first Mishnah, contains a series of questions, which, as I said, for me, constitutes my favorite passage in the Mishnah. The first question is, by the way, I'm going to ask you, I want to be a little more interactive, so I'm going to ask some questions, but the rabbis can't answer, because I suspect they will know the answers. And the rabbis, I have a different question for you. Can you name the 613 commandments? Okay. But anyway, okay, so the first question is, Ezehu Chacham, who is wise? Halomed Mikol Adam, one who learns from everyone. What the rabbis do in the three questions I'm going to raise now is something remarkable. They expand the parameters of free will into areas that we normally think are not covered by free will. Normally, we'd think who is wise, and automatically you'd think, number one, in order to be wise, you probably have to be born right off the bat with a high IQ. Secondly, you probably have had to have had an intensive education. So it's not accessible to everyone. But the rabbis suddenly say anybody can become wise. Anybody who's willing to learn from everybody, who's willing to learn from all their interactions and all their experiences, will become wise. Conversely, somebody who has a very high IQ and very highly educated, but if they're just always talking and they're not absorbing from the various people that they meet, or they feel snobbish and they don't learn from other people, their wisdom is going to diminish. So suddenly they take a trait that doesn't seem so accessible and make it very accessible. Everybody can become wise. Then they ask, Ezehu Gibor, who is a hero, who is a strong person, a hero, HaKoveshet Yitzro, one who can overcome his or her evil inclinations. Now, normally, when we think of the word hero, we think of somebody with great physical courage. My daughter Naomi told me that when she was 4 years old, she thought I was the bravest man in the world. A belief that was shattered when she was six, and we went to an amusement park, and I refused to go on the roller coaster. The problem with defining heroism by physical bravery, and believe me, there are times when physical bravery is required, and we know of it. You read about it in the newspapers. You see it on the news. Anybody who ever, you know, has read an account of what the Israelis did in Entebbe, in that rescue, you know, so we know how important physical courage can be. But the issue is there are two factors. One is it's not that common, physical courage. And secondly, even when you have it, you're not called upon to exercise it very often. But the rabbi said one who overcomes his or her evil inclination is a hero, because that's something we confront every day. We all know what it is, you know, and we all have our own personal weaknesses that we have to deal with. You know, somebody will tell me their problem is that they drink too much. You know, I can't get self-righteous. I happen not to like alcohol. You know, it doesn't make me any, but I have my own things. You want to know what they are? None of your business. But, you know, but we all have the things that we have to overcome, and that is an act of heroism. The most important struggle in which people engage are in the struggle with themselves. It's easy to be heroic and confront, and it's not easy, but to confront other things. But to really, honestly confront yourself is a very big deal. And then the rabbis ask the question, Ezehu Ashir, who is rich? Yeah, one who is content with his lot or satisfied with what he has. The actual literal translation is one who is happy with what he has. And I'll tell you why I prefer that. I've never met any Jew who's satisfied with what he has. Now, and actually, you know, it's a whole interesting thought in Jewish thinking. You are not supposed to ever be satisfied. But can you be happy even when you don't have all that you want? And that, I think, becomes a critical issue. How can we be happy in a life where we only get some of what we want, and how can we appreciate it while we have it? I'll tell you what I mean. All the rabbis here, like me, know that when you're a rabbi, you are disproportionately exposed to happy events in people's lives. You know, you're there at baby namings, you're there at brises, you're there at bar mitzvahs, at bat mitzvahs, at weddings. The unhappy side, or a less pleasant side of being a rabbi, is you're also disproportionately exposed to a lot of unhappiness in people's lives. And I'll tell you a very unpleasant and sad experience one has as a rabbi. You'll meet with people who have suffered some irrevocable loss. It could be a death. It could be an injury, something from which their lives have been permanently transformed and not in a happy way. And sometimes somebody will say to me, you know, Rabbi, if things could only go back to being the way they used to be, I'd be so happy. But I knew that person when things were the way they used to be, and they weren't so happy. There are people who can only appreciate happiness when they no longer have it. And that's tragic. There are things to rejoice in. We should think, even when things are difficult, that some, and think, oh my God, this is terrible. And then be aware that if one of those bad things really happened, we'd suddenly give anything to going back to what our status quo current situation was. And you know who else is interesting to look at when things look bad and bleak? Look in the Bible, to an aspect of the Bible I'm going to speak about now that I find is relatively rarely spoken about. There are many characters in the Bible who go through periods of real sadness and depression and wanting to die. It's not that uncommon. And I'm going to give you examples, and it's surprising because we don't normally think in those terms. Rebecca is having a very difficult pregnancy, and she actually says, "Why should I live?" Rachel goes through a long extended period of infertility, and she says in upset to her husband, "Give me children or I'll die." Moses says to God that he wants to die if Moses is going to give up on the Jewish people. The prophet Jeremiah curses the man, he said, who went around announcing my birth. Jonah, wants to die, if you look in the end of Jonah. Another character who does is Elijah. Now, Elijah, in some ways, is the most interesting because Elijah is the grandfather figure, the most lovable figure in the Jewish folklore. We all know it. What do we associate Elijah with? He shows up at every Seder. I remember I once heard a joke where a Jewish kid and a Christian kid are talking, and the Jew says to the Christian kid, "That's ridiculous. You believe Santa Claus comes to every single house? That's absurd. That's absurd. How could you believe such a stupid thing?" So the Catholic kid says, "Well, don't you believe that Elijah comes to every Seder?" And the Jewish kid says, "Yeah, but there are so many fewer Jews in the world than Catholics." And of course, where else does Elijah show up? He shows up at the bris. So Elijah is this lovable figure. And Christians, when they find that out about Jews, are often taken aback, Christians who've really studied the Bible. Because if you read the Bible, the Elijah who appears in Malachim, in the book of Kings, is actually a very angry, confrontational figure. He's in battle against King Ahab and Ahab's wife, who is Jezebel. And she's brought priests of Baal, and he organizes the Jews to attack them. They kill the priests of Baal. He confronts Ahab on other occasions. And he goes off into the wilderness for 40 days and is very depressed. And he actually says to God he wants to die. Why does he want to die? Because he says, "I'm the only true monotheist left. All the others really have sold you out." And God says to him, first of all, there are 7,000 people who have remained very loyal during this time of Ahab. And God has no pity on him and just sends him back out on his mission. And then Elijah goes on to achieve some very great things. My father, Shlomo Tolushkin, Alav HaShalom, my father offered me an insight that has very much affected me. He said, "Elijah stands in a long line of Jews who were convinced the Jewish people were coming to an end. The first Jew who thought like that was Abraham. But to be fair to him, he was 99 and he still had not had the heir that he wanted to have. And then you had an Elijah." He said, "Let me die. I'm the only one left." I know in the 19th century, there was a big Hebrew scholar in Germany named Moritz Steinschneider. And Steinschneider wrote a history of Hebrew books written between the 8th and 18th century. He was convinced that nobody again would write another book in Hebrew. At a reception at somebody's house, he was introduced to a young man who identified himself as a Hebrew poet, and Steinschneider said to him, "In what century did you live?" In 1965, I was a teenager in high school. There was a cover story in Look magazine, "The Vanishing American Jew." It's now 2017. Look at the Jewish people and look at Look magazine. So my father had an interesting point. He said, Elijah comes along and says the Jewish people are at an end. So what does God send him? What's his fate? He has to show up at every Seder and at every Bris, which remain the two most commonly practiced Jewish rituals. In other words, don't get too pessimistic, because the predictions of the ends of the Jewish people have been coming for too long. It doesn't mean we don't have to resist it in every generation, but we shouldn't ever allow ourselves to be drawn into that level of pessimism. One of the things that draws people into pessimism is when they have unrealistic expectations. You see, the price you pay for having unrealistic expectations is that when you get disappointed, the disappointment becomes even more profound. I was guarded against that and to have realistic expectations by having a mother who was a bit of a pessimist. My mother's famous observation was, "The only people I know are happy are people I don't know well." She was once brought up sharp. I remember when a friend of ours said, "Does that mean that when people come to know you well, they're no longer happy?" But my mother really coined many witticisms that had an effect on me. You know, there's a famous line of Thoreau, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." So my mother said, "Yes, and recently they're not so quiet." Or one of our other lines, "When it's not terrible to be a Jew, it's wonderful." But anyway, I remember my friend Dennis Prager, who knew my mother very well and has often quoted that line in her name, I remember an article he was once writing in which he had read an interview with an actor who at the time was earning millions of dollars for each movie that he made, but was extremely upset because at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was not yet governor but was still acting, was getting $25 million a film, and how much that bothered him. And I remember Dennis said to me, he says, "Can you imagine if this actor chose to compare himself to any of the people who graduated high school with him, he'd be so happy. But he's stacking the deck by comparing himself to one of the few people who's earning more than him." So in other words, to a large extent, what's in our heads determines whether we're going to be unhappy or happy. We can make these comparisons. And it's remarkable because we know even in affluent societies, there's often even more unhappiness. You know, why is it? Part of it is because people feed themselves with unrealistic expectations, and it can make it very hard. I remember when my son Ben, who's now 24, when he was 10, he wrote a script for a film. And he knew I go out to L.A. often, and I had done a little television writing. So he said, "Daddy, I want you to try and sell this script." I mean, for a 10-year-old, the script was okay. So I just sort of was, I knew it wasn't going to really be sold, but I said, "How much would you like to get for it?" So he said, $200,000. And I said, "Oy vey, oy vey." What are some of the techniques we could actually use to become happier? There are things we can cultivate. And by the way, I want you to know, I'm going to review at the end of my talk some of the points that I've raised, because they really have relevance, and some of them you can really take home with you and start incorporating. One is the trait of gratitude, which is the prerequisite trait for being a happy person. Think of the mindset of a grateful person. "Hey, look what so-and-so did for me. He really likes me. Hey, look, she spoke to so-and-so on my behalf. She really cares about me." At the very moment one cultivates gratitude, one is also cultivating a feeling of being loved. Conversely, think of the mindset of the ungrateful person. "Yeah, he always does that for me because now I'll owe him. Yeah, she spoke to him. Now I'll have to speak to someone for her." What an ungrateful person reveals about themselves is not only an emotional stinginess, but how profoundly unloved they feel. But there are so many good people out there in the world who are good for goodness sake, who are good even when there is no immediate payoff for them. But people who are ungrateful are fools. They think that the optimistic people are the naive ones. It's the cynics who by and large are the naive ones because they underrate the amount of goodness in the world. And you can't be cynical and ungrateful and be happy because the world you live in is a loveless world. If everybody's only doing something for some prudential reason, so there's no reason to ever like anybody, to feel love, or to feel loved. So how do you go about cultivating gratitude, particularly if you have pessimistic inclinations? One thing we do at our Shabbat table is we go around the Shabbat table and everybody has to say at least one good thing that happened to them that week. Invariably, there are people who show up at the dinner who've convinced they had a terrible week, nothing good, you know, but if they're forced to think about it, they'll come up with something. "Okay, you weren't prepared for this, so you can tell me anything that's happened in the last month. Anybody tell me here anything good that's happened in their lives in the last month?" Yesterday, the rabbi got to greet the religious school kids one by one as they came out of their cars, and he greeted everyone who came into the school. Right, and I'm sure it made them feel good and made you feel good. That's a good thing. Great. Anybody else? Somebody else? Your son and daughter-in-law, B'Shah Tovah, should all happen in a good hour, expecting their second child. Okay, yes. Okay, you woke up. Okay. No, by the way, that's a good answer, too, and I'll tell you why. If you can learn to be happy over the ordinary events of life, you can really be happy a lot of the time. You see, if one's happiness depends on something extraordinary happening, you're going to be unhappy a lot of the time because life is lived in the ordinary, not the extraordinary. That's the logic of Jewish blessings. Who knows? How many blessings is a Jew ideally supposed to make a day? 100. It's in the liturgy. It's in the prayers. But you're supposed to bless because if you learn to not take anything for granted, then you can appreciate anything good that happens. Yes, somebody else had their hand up. Yeah. You had a baby. Wow. How old is the baby here? Yeah. How old is your baby?
3 weeks.
I want to sign something to that baby later. That might be the youngest person who has ever attended one of my speeches. I want somebody 70 years from now to be able to say, I heard Rabbi Solishkin. Which will be true. They heard me. They have no idea what I said. No, but that's wonderful. I'm very moved. I am very moved. I'm very happy. But anyway, I mean, this is a whole way of looking at things. And what would happen is you start training yourself to appreciate these things. Rituals can have such an interesting impact. For example, it's widely known that the Sabbath is inaugurated with the lighting of 2 Shabbat candles. By a showing of hands, do any of you practice the custom of lighting an additional candle for each child in your house? Okay, yeah, a number of people here do. I grew up with my parents doing that. Abraham Twersky, who was a Hasidic Rebbe, comes from a major Hasidic dynasty, and also a psychiatrist, grew up in such a household. He grew up in Milwaukee, and he was the youngest, and he said his parents lit an extra candle for each child. He said, it was so meaningful for me when I was growing up, knowing that because I existed, there was more light in my parents' household every Friday night. Twersky, as befits a psychiatrist, was addressing the issue that rituals also speak the language of poetry. All parents tell their children that they love them. Hopefully they tell them often. And many of those kids at the age of 25 end up in therapist's office saying, my parents never loved me. So, but here is one powerful way to express it. Or I'll give you another. Do any of you, not any of you, I know some of you do. How many of you practice the custom of blessing your children either on Fridays or before Yom Kippur? It's a beautiful Jewish custom. Some of you might know, well, some of you obviously will know. So what do we say to girls? May God make you like Sarah, Rivka, or Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Logically, we should therefore then say to boys, may God make you like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but we don't. We say to God, we say, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Why do we say that? Well, one is Jacob actually gives that bracha in the Bible. The other reason is they're the only two brothers in Genesis who really get along. Can you imagine? May God make you like Jacob and Esau, you know? Anyway, there's a remarkable book by a woman named Rachel Naomi Remen. Thank you. And she grew up in a household. She said, both my parents were very successful professional people. And it's the sort of household where if I came home with a 98 on a test, my dad would say, what happened to the other 2 points? But every Friday after school, she'd go to her grandfather's house. Her grandfather was a rather pious Jew. And she would spend a couple of hours with him. And he would then light the Shabbat candles and he would bless her. And he gave her the blessing we just spoke about, but he added on something each week to the blessing, something that had happened to her that week that he had appreciated. When she was very young, the first time she was able to sleep through the night with the lights off in her room, she didn't need lights on. If she had done badly on a test in school, but she had made the effort, something else, you know, where she had succeeded. And she said, these were the most peaceful moments of my life, because I was just being accepted for me. And then a very sad thing happened. When she was 7, her grandfather died. And she said at first she wondered how she would be able to go on without those blessings. And she then says something very powerful. She said, "But I found that I had learned from my grandfather to see myself through his blessings. And I have found that when a person is blessed, they can remain blessed forever." Many years later, to Remen's great surprise, her mother started lighting Shabbat candles deep into her 80s. And one night, sitting with her mother on a Friday night, she for the first time told the mother the story of the blessings that her grandfather, the mother's father, used to give her and how much those blessings had meant to her. And Naomi Remen's mother said to her, she said, "Naomi, Rachel, I want you to know I have blessed you every day of your life. Only unlike your grandfather, I didn't have the wisdom to say the blessings out loud." So suddenly what we're finding is that these capacity of these rituals to enrich our lives in remarkable ways or to express the gratitude. I have a friend in South Florida, Jack Reamer, who's a rabbi there who has a remarkable gift at writing sermons, at, you know, being able to really articulate in poetic and non-poetic manners things. So Jack once sent me a poem he had written about the issue of gratitude, written from the perspective of a woman in a relationship. She said, "Remember the day I borrowed your brand new car and dented it? I thought you'd kill me, but you didn't. Remember the time I dragged you to the beach and you said it would rain and it did? I thought you would say I told you so, but you didn't. Remember that time when I flirted with those guys to make you jealous and you weren't? I thought maybe you'd leave me, but you didn't. There were lots of things you didn't do, but you put up with me. You loved me. You protected me. And there were many things I wanted to make up to you when you returned from the war, but you didn't." So we see the real power. We have the ability to express the things now and to do it. We don't want to be one of those people who, God forbid, when somebody leaves us, we only wish we had told them more how much we had loved them and how much, you know, we appreciated all that they did. So this is one thing that I said, you know, the going around the Shabbat table. There's another thing also to declare a complaining fast. What's a complaining fast? Judaism knows, some of you can figure that one out. Judaism knows of food fasts. Obviously, the most famous food fast in Judaism is Yom Kippur. And there's only one other 24-hour complete fast called Tisha B'Av. And then there are other, you know, then there are, but a food fast, okay, so we have, first of all, we have a food fast. And in the Musar movement, a movement towards ethical self-improvement, they developed the idea of a Ta'anit Dibur, of speaking fast, where people would go for 24 hours without saying a word. Most Jews prefer food fasts. But a complaining fast is where people go for 24, 48 hours without complaining about anything. It's, for example, it's now, I did something wrong with this watch. Can I have another watch? What?
It's
7:50. Okay. So wait. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Meeting. Great. So to go for a limited period of time, what causes it? Let's say I'm in a great mood. I had a very productive day at work. Things went well. I arrive home very happy. My wife, though, had a difficult day. So she starts telling me this happened, that happened. The longer she goes on about what a difficult day she had, the more I start reexamining my day. Think you had a hard day? You know what happened to me? Inside of 10 minutes, we're both convinced we're leading miserably unhappy lives. So we declare a complaining fast. Nobody can complain about anything. And then suddenly you become in touch with good things that really are going on in your life. A man told me a story that he was lying in bed one night trying to fall asleep when he thought about his interactions with his 10-year-old daughter since he had come home. When he had first come into the house, her room was very messy, so he got annoyed at her about that. Then at dinner, she had some bad table manners, so he reproved her for that. Then he asked her if she had done her homework. She hadn't, so he was annoyed about that. Then she did her homework, showed it to him. There were mistakes in it, and he was annoyed about that. He was thinking, if his daughter walked into the room and said, "Daddy, do you really love me?" "Of course I love you. I only point these things out because I know how much better you could do." Then he thought if his boss at work treated him the way he treated his daughter, he'd be convinced that the man thought he was an utter incompetent. So he resolved that for 48 hours he wouldn't complain about anything with his daughter, and it put him in touch with all the things he loved about her. Complaining can become like an addictive, very, very unhealthy habit, and we become overly dependent on it, and it becomes our natural reaction to things. It's remarkable. Oh, this is the reason I asked for the watch. If you can go till tomorrow, is it almost 8 o'clock now? Okay, till 7:54 tomorrow, and not complain about anything, just try it. I have only one guarantee. One guarantee. Only this is the only one. None of your family members will say to you, gee, I missed all your complaining. Nobody's ever going to complain about it. Try and see if you can do it for that period of time. And it has the capacity to make us better. By the way, then when you really do have critiques of people, they'll also be taken more seriously and more comfortably. I mentioned earlier the verse, love your neighbor as yourself. That's one of the 613 commandments. It so happens in that one short verse in the Torah, three of the 613 commandments appear. Does anybody know what the other two are? In the same verse in which it says, V'ahavta l'rayacha kamocha, ani Hashem, love your neighbor as yourself, I am God, there are two other laws. Anybody know? Lo tikom v'lo titar. Don't take revenge or bear a grudge against a member of your people. And I want to say something about bearing grudges. I mentioned earlier Rabbi Tversky. When he became a psychiatrist, he's an older gentleman now, so it was in the early 1960s, his specialty in psychiatry was addictive behavior. In the early 60s, addictive behavior referred to alcoholism. By the late 60s, addictive behavior was also referring to drugs. And now it's often used by mental health professionals to refer to a whole series of self-destructive behaviors. But Tversky's specialty was alcoholism. And obviously the main problem for alcoholics is how do you remain a recovering alcoholic? You have to refrain from that first drink. Because the problem alcoholics have is that when they take that first drink, they often have no ability to resist, and then they take a second drink. So he was talking to a recovering alcoholic, and the man said he realized that for him the issue was, when was he most likely to drink? When he was in conflict with somebody, when he was emotionally upset with somebody. And he'd get so upset. You know, the sort of thing where when you wake up in the middle of the night, you have to go to the bathroom, and then you can't fall back asleep because you can't stop thinking about something. So he said in those types of situations, he would often drink. But he learned that he therefore had to avoid those situations. And he then said something so smart to Tversky. It applies to every single one of us here in this sanctuary, even if you don't have any issues with liquor. He said, carrying around a grudge is like allowing the person in the world whom you most dislike to live in your mind rent-free. We are what we think. We are what we think about. In any given day, good things can happen to us and bad things can happen to us. So it's not like there's a totally equal sort of day. But what are the thoughts with which we choose to feed our minds? Are they thoughts that make us more loving? Are they thoughts that make us better to ourselves? Are they thoughts that which we often come up just seeing ourselves as being victims? Carrying around a grudge is one of those destructive thoughts because it then allows the person in the world whom you most dislike to live in your mind like that rent-free. And that's really what we have to avoid. I remember speaking once with a good friend, Harold Kushner, and, you know, Kushner said that there was a woman in his congregation who 10 years earlier, her husband had divorced her. Disgusting. He had left her for a much younger woman, and then he made it very hard. He wasn't making the payments that he was sought to make. He acted in every way despicably, and Kushner said when the divorce happened, he was not surprised and didn't think it wrong that the woman was utterly furious. He said 10 years later, her anger remained unabated, and he said to her, you're walking around carrying a coal for 10 years, ready to throw it at your ex-husband, and all you've done is burn a hole in your hand. So there are times when, for our own mental well-being, we have to learn to let go of those grudges. I just want to quickly touch on a couple of other issues. One thing is the importance of community during difficult times. Recently, I was just speaking very, very briefly now Somebody made the point to me that when they were going through a very difficult time, how important their synagogue was to them. And it's not that this person is such a big prayer, that he loves so much prayer. He said because the community gave him a sense of community. The worst thing that can happen is when you suffer alone. Anybody who's familiar with the Jewish laws of mourning know, whether you're religious or not religious, the brilliance of the laws of Shiva, that when you've lost an immediate family member, you mourn with the community, and the community comes to visit you, how important that is. I knew a young woman who grew up she was not Jewish, and she remembers after her father died, the family, she went home with her mother. They didn't particularly have visitors. They were alone. The community comes together. The Bible starts off in an optimistic way. Six or seven times in the opening chapter of Bereishis, of Genesis, it says, Vayar Elohim ki tov, and God saw that it was good. Who knows the first thing in the Bible that God declares is not good? To be alone. Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's in the second chapter of Bereishit. It is not good for man to be alone. Because that statement occurs in the context of the creation of Eve, so people normally associate it with romantic love. You shouldn't be alone. A man shouldn't be alone. A woman shouldn't be alone. You know, people should be part of a couple. But the truth is, the statement applies to life in general. It is not good for a human being to be alone. And that's why Jewish life has become so community-oriented in the way that it is. And I want to say one, this will then be, I think, my last point, because I think I'm running over my time limit here. And that is this. And it's when I say it first, it's going to sound like an exaggerated statement, but it really isn't. The only possessions that can never be taken from us are the good deeds that we've done. That's the only thing we can't lose. You speak to Jews who were in Germany until the 30s, who were very affluent and who then lost everything. We know that. Jews from the Arab world who had to flee after the creation of Israel in 48. Many of them have been very wealthy, lost everything. The Abarvanel was the finance minister in Spain. He was also a very major Jewish scholar. He wrote a commentary on the Torah. Anyway, he had had a good relationship for a while with the king. Later on, of course, you know what happened. Spain turned against the Jews. But he was the finance minister. But some people started poisoning the king's mind and telling him he's a finance minister, he's been embezzling money for himself. Finally, the king started getting a little suspicious. You know, you can undo anybody if you hear enough bad things about them. So he came to Abarvanel and he said, in 2 days, I want you to present me with a listing of all of your assets. 2 days later, Abarvanel brings him the listing. The king looks at it, and he says, you don't even have your estate listed here. You know, he starts saying, this is not a true list. And he says to him, I know that if you believe all the rumors and lies that are being spread about me, everything I have you'll confiscate. All I listed here was all the charitable acts I've done. That's the only thing that can never be taken from me. So just look at some of the areas we talked about during, whether it's an issue of financial crises or personal crisis. What are you worth? And the answer is not a statement of your financial assets. You're worth an infinite amount because you're in God's image. Love your neighbor as yourself means you also have to cultivate a good self-image, a loving self-image. Who is rich, the Talmud asks, one who is happy with what he has. Can you be happy with what you have even when you don't have all that you want? Can you appreciate what you have while you have it and then not have to wait till it's, God forbid, some of it is lost and then you're happy and then you never have the happiness while it's actually going on? Having realistic expectations about yourself and about others. As my mother used to teach, the only people I know are happy are people I don't know well. The recognition why gratitude is the prerequisite trait for being a happy person. Ways to go around and cultivate gratitude. Try and do this at the next family meal you have. If you have it on a Shabbat, do it on a Shabbat. If you have it on another occasion, do it then. But having everybody going around and saying something good that has happened to them within this last short period of time, within the last week or the last 2 weeks. Declare periodic complaining fasts. Try that now. By the way, now you only have to do it for 23 hours and 45 minutes since I mentioned it. I remember I once tried to challenge people to go for a day without saying anything negative about anybody. It's something I want. I was able to get two senators. Then it was Joe Lieberman and Connie Mack to introduce a resolution to establish a Speak No Evil Day in the United States. I'm going to try and I'm doing a rewriting, a revising of my book, Words That Hurt, and I want to try and do that. Can people do that? So I used to do that with people. Can you go for 24 hours? Some people said, well, I can only do 2 hours. Then they volunteered, 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. You know, so I said, if you're only going to do 2 hours, do it during meal times. Resist bearing grudges, because carrying around grudges is like allowing the person in the world whom you most dislike to live in your mind rent-free. To be part of a community. To remember, there is so much psychological wisdom in the Torah. My dear friend Joel Alperson, where's Joel? My dear friend Joel Alperson and I were working together with our friend Dennis Prager on a Torah commentary, but the focus of this commentary is on what are lessons we can actually extract from the Torah for our daily lives. And how do these things really can impact us on a daily basis? And one of them is so profound, that teaching. It's a few words in the Bible. Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's not good for Adam means both man, as in male, but it also means a person. It's not good for a person to be alone. And how important the community becomes at that time. And a recognition that the only asset we can never lose are those acts of kindness and charity we do for others. I know I mentioned it in the case of Abarvanel, his charitable acts that he listed, but it's also the acts of kindness. There's something so meaningful. Sometimes somebody will come up and I'll be so happy. They'll tell me of something that I did for them and how important it was to them. And all of us have done things like that. And all of us have the capacity to do that. Nobody, you know, Anne Frank in her diary, Anne Frank, you get shocked, she was 15 when she was killed. And in her diary, one of the points she makes is, nobody needs wait another minute to start making the world better. Because it can just be done through every interaction that we have with other people. A little over 200 years ago, one of the great early masters of the Hasidic movement, Nachman of Bratslav, died. Reb Nachman was a great-grandson of the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov. And one of the things Nachman taught was, if you're not going to be better tomorrow than you were today, what need do you have for tomorrow? I once concluded a speech like that, and Joseph said, you know that, and somebody said to me, Joseph, that's a real downer way to conclude a speech. If you're not going to be better tomorrow than you were today, what need do you have for tomorrow? So let me amend Nachman's words. I wish all of you a very good today and an even better tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You've been listening to a lecture program from the Jewish Federation of Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Joseph Telushkin, rabbi at the Synagogue for the Performing Arts in Los Angeles and author of several books, including Jewish Literacy, The Most Important Things to Know About the Jewish Religion, Its People, and Its History, and with Dennis Prager, The 9 Questions People Ask About Judaism, and Why the Jews, The Reason for Anti-Semitism. He spoke on the topic, The Sky Is Not Falling, God, Love, and Money in Times of Crisis. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 20th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jenny Gates Beckman, Director of Community Engagement and Education with the Jewish Federation of Omaha, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.